Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Larry Diamond. He is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. It's out in Stanford University, and he is also the author of the brand new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Penguin Press. Larry, one of the age-old arguments that we hear just at the street level, I guess, of politics is America is not a democracy. It's a representative republic. How does that fit into your narrative?
Well, we don't want a unmitigated majoritarian form of democracy that can run roughshod over our civil liberties and the rule of law. Our framers wisely recognized the dangers of that, and so they put breaks in the Constitution that made it a representative democracy and not just a repeated plebiscite where 50% plus one could do anything they wanted. That's why we have such a strong and independent judicial system. It's why we had indirect election of senators. It's why we have the Electoral College. We want to give people direct rights to express themselves. I believe in the initiative in the referendum. We don't want an indirectly elected Senate, but we do want to temper the power of a narrow majority to suppress the rights of other Americans and to degrade the rule of law, and that's why we have a representative democracy.
Part of the subtitle of your book included the term American complacency, and you sounded a warning bell throughout the book, but it harkened me back to a bit that George Carlin used to do. He talked about the American okey-doke, where people, all they care about is just getting up, going to work, and using their iPhones, and they don't care about anything else. Is that kind of what you're getting at with this complacency, where it's, you know, tyranny by inaction?
Well, that's the definition of complacency, but I think we are facing circumstances much more challenging and worrisome than the traditional problems of the American okey-doke. We have deepening polarization in the United States and inability of people who are strong partisans of one party or another to talk to one another or even listen to one another. An inability to build coalitions across party lines to get things done. You know, in the era of Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, they were able to get together and negotiate to save the Social Security system for another 30 or 40 years. Now we're facing another crisis of the viability and fiscal sustainability of this crucial guarantee of an income floor for retired Americans. And what is the prospect that Republicans and Democrats can agree again on this in this kind of political context? And we have a president who on a daily basis is lying egregiously about a wide variety of things and violating basic constitutional norms and principles, whether it's the soft and unwritten norms of respect for the press and tolerance of opposition, or the harder norms of checks and balances.
We saw this recently when former Vice President Joe Biden was criticized by several of the other Democrats running the presidential primary when he made the comment that he had negotiated with segregationists. He was able to form a political connection to actually get things done. And the other Democrats, whether it's because he's the front runner or they really believe it, just pounce on him talking about how could you negotiate with segregationists. But realistically, the whole idea of negotiating with somebody who believes in something that you don't, vehemently don't, that's sort of the whole basis of how this democracy and this representative republic is supposed to work, right?
It is indeed, and I found this piling on the former vice president for this statement a little bit depressing. Of course, you know, Joe Biden always has a tendency to say things in a less than articulately precise way, so sometimes he lands himself into a bit of trouble, and this is not a statement in support of his candidacy or against his candidacy. But the point is, he did epitomize the effort to work across the partisan divide in the Congress, or the ideological divide, and build coalitions that could improve the lives of people. And, you know, the I think additional evidence that there's a good bit of momentary political opportunism in this is the fact that was pointed out on one news show in this last election, news cycle, that the liberal icon Ted Kennedy had said the same thing in his memoir, that this is what he did to reach out to some of these segregationist senators, including Senator Eastland, to try and get progressive legislation in other areas. And the point is, you work with who you can. Look, there are people coming from the Nancy Pelosi kind of progressive side of the Democratic Party and the hard right Freedom Caucus who probably each regard the other as a threat to the Republic on all sorts of cultural, social, and who knows, economic issues. But in confronting the challenge of a rising neo-totalitarian communist Chinese regime that is, I would say, increasingly existentially threatening freedom in the world and the national security of the United States, they are ready to cooperate to make America more resilient in the face of these dangers. And more power to them for doing so.
When you look at this from a global perspective, you mentioned Russia and China in the subtitle. How does this whole idea, as you try to educate people on this, how is that going to resonate with somebody that's going to work at a blue-collar job every day? Why should he or she care about this Russian rage or Chinese ambition?
Well, the Chinese ambition part of it is kind of easier to connect to the daily life of American workers whose jobs are increasingly threatened by globalization and economic integration, and in the case of China, by the relentless 30-year campaign that they've been on to steal our technology and put a lot of our workers out of business. Now, that is not the only reason why China has been surging forward in a lot of forms of production. And why it's surging forward now in terms of its military strength, particularly in East Asia and the Western Pacific. But it's worrisome enough. And I think we sell short and disrespect farmers, blue-collar workers, ordinary Americans who may not have foreign policy-linked jobs, or, you know, knowledge-centered jobs in the universities or think tanks or whatnot. We sell them short and disrespect them when we suggest that they are not concerned about the national security of the United States, and all they care about is, you know, their immediate financial stability. I think that's just not true, and I think the imperative is to educate all American citizens about the new world we have entered. They're used to thinking over the last 20 years, 25 years, it's a post-Cold War world. The United States is unchallenged in its power and its global leadership, and so we can afford to draw back and, quote, worry about our own problems and needs. Well, it's a different world now, where Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, among others, pose more palpable threats to our national security, and where Russia brazenly intervened in our democratic process in 2016 and has made it clear it's going to do it again in 2020, and indeed is already doing it now. So I think the imperative is an educational one, and the American public will respond.
I'm chatting with Larry Diamond, author of the brand new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. The book's available now from Penguin Press. Larry, as people have thought about this whole idea about democracy over the last, you know, 50 or so years, we saw it with Vietnam, where The whole idea was to stop the spread of communism and essentially promote democracy. And then in my generation, in my adulthood, we saw it with trying to nation build in Iraq. Are those military solutions to stopping the spread and promoting democracy, are those a viable option anymore?
No, I think we should never go to war to promote democracy. We should only go to war to defend our national security. And the Iraq experience, which I was briefly involved in and wrote another book about, I think was a powerful lesson in that regard. We don't need to use military force to try and advance and defend freedom and democracy in the world. There are people all over the world now, right now, in the streets of Hong Kong and the streets of Khartoum, Sudan, in the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan, and many other places that are mobilizing to defend the principle of free and fair elections, to defend the rule of law and their civil liberties, as 2 million people in the streets of Hong Kong have tried to do, challenging the most powerful authoritarian regime in the world. All they need is our help, our solidarity, in some cases training for their legislators and civil society organizations, in some cases some financial support for the work they're trying to do. This is peaceful work of international solidarity and democratic support that's nonviolent, that puts Democrats in other countries in the lead and stands in solidarity behind them. And our military force should be used only to defend the security of our own country and our vital democratic allies, and to deter aggression by countries like Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea.
In addition to a geography and history lesson in the book, I also had I learned a new word, kleptocracy. I'd never heard that before, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I never had. Can you explain what that is and why it's important for the book?
Well, the literal root of the word is rule by thieves, and it's not a bad description of what you've got in Russia right now, for example, or in Venezuela. Or I'd say in a different and more subtle way, the People's Republic of China, because the Communist Party of China is just riddled with corruption. But the distinctive feature of kleptocracy is not that you just get an inside group of oligarchs and autocrats who are controlling the nation's finances and looting them at will. It's also that they move their money and assets abroad secretly, non-transparently, and then begin to distort the rule of law and the workings of other democracies through financial transactions, then kind of laundering their wealth and making it respectable, then using lobbying and the prestige donations to art museums and universities and so on. And the antidote to this is that we've got to stop the ability of these kleptocrats to move money surreptitiously and have it wash on our shores and into our banking and real estate systems. We've got to ban anonymous shell corporations from serving as a vehicle for doing this. We've got to ban anonymous real estate transactions. We need to know who's bringing money into our country, who's buying assets in our country, who's buying luxury real estate in our country, and then we can decide whether we want these people to be penetrating our finances and our politics and civil society or not.
Does any of this argument mimic the whole idea of the border wall argument? Because really it'd be closing down the financial system to outsiders and who do it illegally. Is it sort of the same argument that we see from the folks that want the borders closed to people entering illegally?
Well, we're not hearing it from the people who want the borders closed, but I think there is a certain philosophical affinity between the two arguments, and it is about the integrity of our borders and our ability to govern them. And to come back to the money laundering issue, the issue is not closing off trade, for sure, or even international financial flows. The issue is transparency, that you can't infiltrate your stolen funds from the country of origin into Europe, into London, into New York, and other equity and property markets in the United States. Without transparency and without the ability of proper regulators in the United States to evaluate and have a chance to approve or deny these transactions.
So what entities or entity in the United States is the biggest opponent of this?
Well, for one thing, all of the accountants and lawyers who are getting and representational agents who are getting rich off representing these kleptocrats and helping them move and disguise the real origin of these transactions. Secondly, I hate to say it, the states of Delaware and Wyoming, which are the two biggest havens, the two biggest sites for the anonymous registration of shell companies in the United States. Delaware, most of all. And, look, I sympathize with the state of Delaware, which is getting, a quarter of a third or a third of all of its state revenue from registering these anonymous shell companies. And I don't envy the financial quandary they'll be put in when that ready source of income stops flowing into them. But I'm sorry, the national security of the United States is more important.
All right. The book is Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. He's Larry Diamond. He wrote the book, and he's sounding the alarm bell that he wants folks to listen to. Larry, fantastic book, completely interesting and opened my eyes to a lot of stuff, and thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Listening to the wind of change.